Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
What would make you feel better as a South African? Is it a relief to you that the EFF are not going to be in the chamber? They're going to be watching it virtually. Does that bring you any comfort? I think it does me, you know. I got a little bit tired of the histrionics of the EFF marching out every time. You know, we did get to a point that we needed to hear the president and we needed to hear what he has to say. Now I'm a little concerned that it's all we do is get to hear what the president has to say. We don't get to ask him questions. We don't get to engage and to interrogate anything further. Well, Sona doesn't seem to be any different. It appears to be following that road. That said, is it an important Sona? Have we not heard enough from the president? Isn't it time, maybe, that he stops talking and starts doing? Well, that might be my view, but joining us on the line is an accountant, academic, activist, and columnist, Kaya Sithole. And I have to say, an incredible investigative journalist. I think his writing is superb. He takes on things that other people don't. It's an absolute privilege to chat to him. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, and good morning to the listener.
Sona, this evening, is it going to be much ado about nothing again? Do you think that this is something that we should have high expectations for?
I think the reality of where we are and the fact that what is really preoccupying the minds of all South Africans is how this pandemic is being managed simply means that that is really the only point of interest for a lot of us. And the interesting thing about that is that obviously because the president keeps giving us regular updates, a lot of us are probably quite comfortable with where we are, even though we may not be happy with where we are in how the pandemic is being managed. But at least we know what the government is doing on an ongoing basis and the bungles that they've had. So that really is the most important thing that can come out of this particular conversation. Everything else that the president might speak to is then going to remind us of the fact that from the moment he delivered his first State of the Nation address in February 2018, he, just like his predecessor, has been crippled by the fact that the things that they put into that particular address, the commitments that they made, hardly ever get matched by reality. So when you remember the first time he spoke to us, and I think also in 2019, he was speaking about high-speed trains and great
country where CASA has completely collapsed. And I forgot about infrastructure.
So you would think that if a president has got this habit of really just putting out them really wild and ambitious ideas that no one ever follows upon, a lot of people have seen the folly of that. And the only point of interest that we might have is to simply say, okay, fine, what is the government's plan in relation to managing the pandemic for the rest of the year? Everything else, we know it's just populist semantics that have got nothing to do with the picture of reality.
The truth is, though, that COVID presents the government, actually every government, but let's just focus here. It presents governments with an incredible opportunity to hit the reset button, because he can always say, well, you know, cyber cities and fast trains and all sorts of things. Well, we couldn't implement any of that because the world shut down last year. There is a global pandemic. But along with that, along with the ability to reset, comes the commitment to make a change. Do you think we've seen a change at all within? And we're definitely hearing the right words, and we're speaking about things which is better than not speaking about them. But are we seeing the change?
No, and I think the one example that one always can refer to is the Eskom example. So if you remember, how we've been led to believe is that at times of peak demand, when industry is in full flow and everybody is at work, that's when there is a strain on the grid. Mm-hmm. Now, if you then recall that during hard lockdowns, there was clearly no hard economic activity, industry was shut down, and we were all forced to stay at home, you'd have thought at that point in time that the demand was at its lowest, which presented indeed a golden opportunity for Eskom to strategically say that regardless of the shifts between level 5 and level 4, for example, we are going to shut down that particular power plant and do all the maintenance that is necessary in order to ensure that it doesn't keep breaking down over the next year. So that's what the opportunity for reset means. It means that you take the strategic call, you make the strategic call to say that we're going to utilize this moment of crisis in order to ensure that we future-proof ourselves ourselves and our citizens from future disruptions. Well, guess what? Even now, while we're still operating at below optimal economic activity, we get randomly told within 47 minutes notice that we're now being plunged into level 3 load shedding. So the capacity of the government to actually utilize a crisis in order to change the way it does things quite simply has not been utilized. Similarly, this Monday, the president issued an extraordinary newsletter whose very first paragraph was a complete fabrication of facts, because he said that he was completely surprised and completely taken aback by the scale of corruption.
He's constantly surprised. Yeah.
Well, my simple question was, if you were surprised by what happened, then you probably aren't the type of person who understands what's happening within the state, and more importantly, within the type of political alliances that have led us to this type of corruption crisis that this country is suffering from. So yes, it was an opportunity to reset. A lot of governments used it. This government squandered it.
I've become very skeptical, and I've been chatting to our listeners about it, and I'd love your thoughts on it, around this whole notion of there being two ANCs. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant strategy, because anything that is corrupt and bad, we just throw over the wall into the bad ANC group, and then we manage to somehow keep the branding of the good ANC a little bit protected. What are your thoughts on that? Is it deliberate? Was it just opportunistic, or has this just evolved this way? And how do we address that?
Yeah, I think some aspects of it are indeed a manufactured dichotomy, because the ANC does not lose out when it has the capacity to then say, wait, if you hear about something that's bad, no, it isn't the ANC, but it's that part of the ANC that we already know is subject to rogue elements. So it does actually assist their PR campaigning, but that only works for people who are of the opinion that you can split the ANC into two. I'm not of the view that there are two ANCs. I'm of the view that there's one ANC, and that singular ANC is led by the same person who was the deputy president even during the time that he now refers to as the 9 wasted years. So I think the PR campaigning around Cyril Ramaphosa that seeks to insulate him from the issues of the past and then tries to cloak him as some island within a sea of corruption, even in the current model, just doesn't wash with me, because then the question that has to be asked is, what is the point of having these enormous powers associated with not only being an ANC president, but also the country's president, when people can literally run rings around you, when people can engage in corrupt activities around you, and your only defense is that, well, it wasn't me yet, it was members of the ANC. I mean, this is a president whose greatest embarrassment is that at a time when the country literally put its hands together and said, in spite of your history as a party of kleptocrats, we are going to put our hands together in solidarity, we're going to raise funds, and we're going to support the relief efforts, only for his own spokesperson, one of the closest people to him, to then find herself entangled in the corruption mess that we all had said that, in spite of your history, we are going to give you one more chance. It's quite extraordinary that even almost a year after that was discovered, he hasn't had the presence of mind to then think, perhaps I should not be associated with this person, regardless of what the disciplinary process outcomes are, because it really has just dented the faith that people had in his ability to distinguish himself from the rest of the mess that characterizes his party. So yes, that false dichotomy of the two ANCs, I'm not a big fan of it.
Clearly not, and very, very well put. The question then, I guess, is what follows is what will it take for South Africans not to vote for the ANC? Is it about loyalty to a historic Freedom Party, or is it about just not having a suitable option? Because whether we want to believe it or not, the DA is not a home for many people in South Africa. The EFF is not a home for many people in South Africa, which leaves them wanting, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is indeed a combination and perhaps an intersection of the historical attachments that a lot of voters have with the ANC, and also the fact that it's just difficult to find a credible opposition party that is able to outline why its program of action is better than the ANC, rather than why its program of action is anti-ANC, because I think there's a huge difference between being anti-ANC and being better than the ANC, and the opposition parties haven't got it right so far. I mean, you saw yesterday that extraordinary diatribe from the EFF that is accusing AXA of privatizing when AXA has said, look, we are struggling to run our operations. Here are some non-core assets that we can sell off in the short term so that we do not become a burden on the state. That is precisely what we've been accusing all the other state-owned enterprises of being a burden on the state. So because the EFF is in opposition, then they come out and then they complain about the fact that, well, if you're selling particular assets, then it means that Ramaphosa is busy selling state-owned enterprises. It is intellectual nonsense. It is absolute rubbish. But, of course, because they're an opposition party, that's what they must do. So imagine a person who's trying to say, I've decided that I no longer want to vote for the NC. I'm looking for an alternative, only for them to stumble upon something that is so intellectually deficient and quite simply, you know, nonsensical. It just becomes difficult for them to be able to establish what the home is. And I think we are, unfortunately, moving towards a stage where people are going to prefer to stay at home, simply because they look at the ballot paper and they say, hey, it's an alliance of incompetence and I'm not going to bother and queue up and cast my vote alongside any of them because I don't see what it is that they're trying to put together or they're trying to move the country.
What do you make of this Tea Party that happened last week? It left me a little perplexed.
It was a PR political campaign for exactly one individual, Julius Malema. Julius Malema cannot lose from what happened in the aftermath of the Tea Party because there are now only two outcomes. The first outcome is that Jacob Zuma may indeed show up in Bramfontein and take the stand, or he may not. If he does show up and take the stand, it will be Julius Malema who will be known as the only politician who had the presence of mind to go and speak some sense into him and convince him to come. The ANC was busy trying to figure out what to do. Esma Khashulu was saying you must stay away from him. And Cyril Ramaphosa, quite extraordinarily, said that we must give him space and time. We do not know what that means. If a person threatens to defy the Constitution and the Constitutional Court, yeah. I don't believe that space and time is
I mean, if you summoned to a court, can you ask for some space and time? I didn't even know
In the eyes of Cyril Ramaphosa, that's what you can do. So right. That is the one possibility that if Zuma does show up, it will be Julius Malema, who was the only person at the presence of mind to convince him to do so. If he doesn't show up, of course, it becomes then the EFF's own political campaigning slogan to say, well, look at these rogue elements that you guys have put in charge of the country. They are openly defying the Constitution, and yet again, only Malema can win from that PR campaign. So it was a masterstroke from him in that regard. And I think, obviously, the fact that he got everybody entranced by it when I kept saying that there's nothing of substance happening here, it does speak to the fact that we are in a political system where there is so little that goes in the way of substantive political engagement, even the artificial and the superficial, like that Tea Party of last weekend, have become the type of thing that we gravitated towards focusing on, which is a tragedy of where we are.
So what are you hoping for? What would you like to hear this evening at SONA?
Perhaps we shouldn't have had the SONA at all because I have absolutely zero in the way of expectation. I think, obviously, the key issue here is that the government is going to use the coronavirus pandemic in multiple ways. So in instances where they have to explain why they haven't done any of the things that they said they will do, corona will be the reason. And in instances where they come up with ambitious plans, corona will be the baseline for saying, now we learned to do things differently. Now we've pressed the reset button. So you're going to see multiple references to the pandemic as being, the golden child that leads us to this reset pathway that gets things done differently. And it also becomes a great stumbling block that explains why the things we told you 2, 3, or 4 years ago have not been done. So it's really a political speech that's going to come in peaks and troughs, where suddenly the coronavirus being the baseline is going to be equally savaged and equally praised, if you want to look at it that way.
Absolutely, and I think that I actually wonder how many people are going to even tune in. If I didn't have a responsibility to speak about it tomorrow morning, I'm not sure that I would. I have to say, and I don't know.
I share those sentiments. I'm really not looking forward to it. There's not much to look forward to.
I'm trying to think if I can maybe just, keep it on and then answer emails at the same time. But I don't know that I could fully focus on this. I don't know. because it's just, you know, as you said, it's just more words. And I think it's so many words. It's, Cyril Ramaphosa has almost become the Hamlet of politics. You know, this debating and deciding and, but in action. And we know what happens at the end of Hamlet. Everybody dies. It's a tragedy because we need action. And that's the one thing we're not seeing.
And I think obviously, maybe the fact that we've had so many more engagements with him over, you know, a couple of months when he's had to update us on the coronavirus pandemic simply means that people have got a much closer understanding of what the issues are relating to the pandemic. And again, as I said earlier on, nothing much else matters at this stage, because if you come and promise people jobs, they know you're not going to deliver them. If you come and promise people that you're going to unbundle Eskom, that conversation started in 2018. And here we are 3 years later, and nothing has been done. And yesterday, I actually was on another Afrikaans TV program where the spokesperson of Eskom is now saying that the timeline for the project is 2023. And yet, even now, for 3 or 4 years after they came up with it, now in a position to explain exactly what is the point of splitting Eskom into three, what will it do in relation to solving the country's energy crisis? So I think for a lot of people, they're going to listen and say, we've heard this before, and actually we know that you don't have the courage to deliver. All we need is just vaccine so we can move on with our lives and not have to be so entranced by what politicians of the day say, because it clearly means that they don't have much to say at all.
Absolutely right. Accountant, academic, activist and columnist Kaya Sitole, thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Really fascinating conversation and very interesting take on the situation.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.